This is the Political Show and Tell, a podcast revealing the personalities of people in political thinking. I'm your host, Tanya Lesenska.
This week, I'll be talking to François Laffont, who is
author of an op-ed column on the Jean Le Cornu Institute website and is also an author of NATO, Rethink, Realign, React. I will have both links in the description of the episode. Stay tuned to learn more about the difficulties when advising a minister, how the pandemic can serve as a space to refound the European Union, and how a conversation between two friends led to a book on the Erasmus generation and its translation to another language. François Laffont is special advisor to the Deputy Prime Minister for European Affairs in the government of North Macedonia, but he was sent there by the French government as an international expert. Globally, there are about 500 such experts sent via agreements between the governments so the expert can help on specific issues. He has been in North Macedonia for the last 3 years and has already witnessed some landmark events, such as the end of the 27-year-old name dispute with Greece and the signing of the Treaty for Good Neighborly Relations with Bulgaria. The goal is for North Macedonia to become a member of the EU. However, there have been some setbacks since 2019, when the start of EU negotiations was blocked by France in order for the negotiation framework to be reformed, and then recently by Bulgaria, that wants to renegotiate outstanding disputes between the two countries. On top of that, Skopje had to hold snap elections provoked by the first veto on opening negotiations.
I mean, you know that France has, for long years, a very active diplomacy, and in particular in Africa. So I think that most of my colleagues, I mean 80% of my colleagues, they are in Africa because of bilateral agreements with France in order to help African countries on specific topics. It could be health, it could be education, it could be security, it could be infrastructure, whatever. So when there are this kind of agreements, then the French government is looking for specialist experts in the specific field in order to be sent for short, medium or long period in the country in order to do the duty that they have agreed. So this is something which is useful because, of course, one country could help with the aid, with some grants, with some financial supports or guarantee. But in this case, this is also something in addition. So that means that this is human resource that we put at the disposal of the country which wants to be helped on a specific topic.
Yeah, this is exactly why I thought it was a very interesting approach, because coming from a country that, you know, rather recently became a member of the EU, I can see that it would actually be good to have someone with this expertise, with any sort of expertise, coming from a state that has a long history of, you know, like France has a long history of diplomacy, but also other types of institution building. So I thought, from that perspective, it was a really interesting approach.
We are not the only one country to do that. I mean, I have met, for instance, one colleague from Germany here in the Ministry for Foreign Affairs in North Macedonia, also somebody from Hungary. So France is not the only one, and I'm not talking about the Americans or other, but there is this possibility to have formal agreement between governments in order to make sure that everything is done at the light of everybody. And this is my case. I mean, everybody knows here that I am the French expert based in the administration in charge of the European integration, and try to help them according to my own experience, according to my background, to make sure that they are going in a good orientation. So this is, I think, this is very useful, and this is a kind of friendship system also, because I am paid by the French government. I'm free for this for the Macedonian authorities.
This isn't the first time he's had to advise ministers. In the early 2000s, he advised the Italian Under Secretary of State of Foreign Affairs and the Italian Minister for Regional Affairs. However, this time, he was invited by a member of the Italian government. François already spoke Italian after doing his PhD in Florence at the European University Institute and had a formidable network of contacts. By the time he got invited by the Italian government, François had already worked with Jacques Delors in Paris and as a deputy director of the Policy Network in the UK, which is a think tank close to the Prime Minister of the time, Tony Blair. He already had the necessary experience in organizing working groups and advocacy on specific issues.
And it was very extremely useful also for them, because they've got not only the Italian point of view of any problems, issues, topics, but they use also to have an external point of view. And I think, I mean, if I remember perfectly what I have done at this time, it was a kind of added value in the decision-making process that they were taking. So I remember perfectly that I have been traveling to India several times, to Afghanistan, to Pakistan, to all countries in Central Asia. I've been also in New York at the UN General Assembly within the Italian diplomatic team. And it was a kind of Europeanization of a policy, because you've got a non-citizen participants having his own experience and giving them some advice or some perception how things will be perceived by non-Italian. So this is why I think that it was very useful for both, because of course for me it was very useful.
The first time I met François was a few days after the French veto on negotiations with North Macedonia. I was organizing a strategy group on the Western Balkans, which was only missing representatives from North Macedonia and France, until he confirmed his participation. I was sure that everyone would still be so shocked by the veto that it would overpower the discussions. Instead, François offered an explanation of the French. During our interview, he also told me about the difficult position he was in.
Yes, it was not an easy moment, of course, for a French expert based in North Macedonia to be a bit in the middle of two countries which were not absolutely on the same line. I mean, they were not understanding each other. So it was not so much a French veto at this point. It was more something which was the process is not working so well. Let's try to find a way to make sure that we will help you. I mean, it was the intent of the French president at this time, but it was not perceived in such a way by most of the countries in the Western Balkans and even in some other European Union member. So the point was to explain, because my role, I mean, from the start, I mean, of course, this is when I was in Italy, when I was before in UK, and now again, the point is to try to explain, to understand what's going on, and to explain, I mean, to find solutions, to... of course, this is like all diplomatic exercise, to try to find a common ground when we have different perceptions. In this case, concerning the enlargement process and the French attitude, it was more to explain that maybe this is not working so well, and the fact was, in a certain sense, explaining also that, showing that. I mean, if you look, we are negotiating with Turkey for more than 15 years, with Montenegro more than 8 years, Serbia 6 years, and the process of membership is not going so quickly. So the point of the French president at this time was to say maybe there is something that we should address and to make some to put in place better instruments. So it was the request of having a kind of new methodology, which then the people they have understood the purpose of this exercise, and it has been adopted in March. So now we have this new tool. Maybe the points that was raised at this time are not stupid at all. Look at the situation. I mean, still the process is not going well, and this is not France which is blocking. So there was something behind that at the first moment was not so well perceived, and it was good, and that's why I did try that this time to explain the intent or the background of a decision made by the French president.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you that the new structure has a better chance of being more fair to both sides of the negotiations and perhaps not allowing for negotiations to get stuck as they happened with Turkey. So I'm looking forward to seeing how this is going to work once it actually gets into motion. But as you said, you often find yourself in very difficult times. And recently with the Bulgarian veto of starting negotiations with North Macedonia. So I'm curious to know, because you're working in an environment that, you know, decisions matter, advice matters. So, you know, you're in a situation where Bulgaria vetoes or something else like that happens, and the minister says, okay, Francois, what do we do now? So how does it happen in your head? Like, how do you give advice in those moments?
Well, you know that this is not... I'm not taking the decision. So sometimes this is, of course, easier in a certain sense to formulate proposals or alternatives or scenario. But at the end, I'm not the one taking the responsibility of the decision. So, of course, I am accountable of what I'm writing, what I'm saying, and what I'm proposing. But at the end, there is always somebody who is taking the decision. This is the politician or the diplomats or whatever. So how to arrive to formulate the advice? First dimension is, of course, to work a lot, exactly like if you were in capacity to take a decision. But then at the same time, you have to have a lot of empathy and to understanding the whole context, and in particular, the other side. So you have to be also in capacity to say, I'm not the one taking the decision, but I want to understand the other one. And this is a very personal way of thinking. So you have to try to be the most neutral possible and to take all the information, to process that in order to formulate something where you will consider that this is acceptable by both sides. So this is a win-win solution. So the job is always to try to find a win-win solution, because if you want to impose something or if you don't take into account what the other is thinking and would like, then you're sure that the decisions maybe will be okay for a short time, but then on the long run it will not work. So this is the difficulty of the game. So of course you can use the tools, the game theory or whatever, but at the end you have to be to work and to understand the whole context. And this is easier for me in a certain sense, because I'm not Macedonian. So I can extract me from a certain number of elements or pressure that could oblige me to think in a single way. Now, I have the capacity to extract myself from the problem and try to find a win-win solution. That means that everybody may not be fully agree, but this is the more rational way to move forward.
What is one of the hardest situations, in your opinion, that you found yourself in over the years?
Well, maybe what you mentioned before. I mean, when it was a bit difficult between France and North Macedonia because of this misunderstanding of the French position, and when you are embedded in the administration, you have to face your colleagues with whom you work in a daily mode, and you can see their eyes that they don't understand what's going on from the country that you're coming from. Even if they know that you're not responsible for that, they still consider that you may be one element of this decision-making process in your own country. So you have to face that. And of course, this is, I mean, even if the people, they are very nice, this is sometimes not very easy. So that's one. Another time, but it was more on a physical dimension, I was traveling with the Italian government in Uzbekistan, and I was looking for an internet coffee in order to send some message. And the people knew that I was a French there. And I mean, I've been more in a problematic situation in terms of security for myself. I have understood that maybe I was not at the right place at the right moment for X reasons that I did not understood at this time. But I feel I was a bit uncomfortable, so I escaped before finishing to send my emails. So it depends. I mean, sometimes this is very without any logic, but you have a specific fear because of the place that you are. And sometimes there is good reasons to understand that the people may not like you, or they may you feel bad in the environment.
So you've mentioned two types of let's call it stress, basically. So one type is the emotional one of, you know, having to face colleagues in a situation where, you know, it's about the two countries and some misunderstanding. And the other one is the physical aspect, literally being in a place where you don't feel safe. And on top of that, during the years, you've occupied positions that are, you know, at the level of director. So I know from personally working with people at similar positions that this is a very tolling schedule. You have a lot to do during the day, sometimes during the night. So I'm curious to know, what has kept you going in these moments?
Maybe the sense of duty, maybe the will to do the things in the correct way. I mean, I am in charge of something, I have a mission. I want to accomplish it in such a way that the people that trust me will be satisfied with what I'm doing. So, of course, you have to restrain yourself. You have a lot of sacrifice. That means making sure that you have a life which is organized. This is maybe things which are stupid, but I try to avoid the dinner and the evening out, because I know that then the day after I will not be efficient in the same way, and so on. So you have to have a life which is also organized in order to be also always available to your minister, if you are advisor to a minister or to somebody else. So this is also to be available at any moment, because it could be night, it could be a day or hours also. So you have to organize yourself in such a way to be at the top at any moment.
So it's interesting that you mentioned sense of duty, and then you mentioned, you know, not going to dinner, or, you know, a lot of these conferences, actually the networking happens in a sort of a reception. It runs late into the night, but this is stuff that you're willing to skip in order to be, you know, efficient in the next day. So to me, that sounds a bit, you know, a bit like in terms of maybe stoic in the sense of the philosophy of having a duty and doing what needs to be done and this sort of thing. So I'm curious to know, do you have a certain set of values or a certain set of kind of philosophy that you ascribe to and try to follow?
I have my own values, of course. And of course, I have a political orientation or something which is driving me. I mean, the making sure that Europe is getting stronger has always been a driver in any of my positions, and still. So there are also other specific values. I mean, justice, the sense of trying to help the poorest or to be more demanding from the one who have more than the others. I mean, of course, everybody has then a personal hierarchy of things which are important and choices that you will make even when you're writing a comment or when you're proposing advice. You will do it in function of your own sense of what should be a good society and how it should work. But I would say that, yes, Europe and a sense of justice will be the two main drivers of what I have done till now.
And talking about Europe, I'm going to take you a bit to when you were my age and maybe even a bit younger when you were studying. I believe it was European Studies. So at that point, what is now the European Union was the European Community, and several very landmarkish things happened. So the Maastricht Treaty and the adoption of the euro and the community grew in terms of members. So what drove you into the direction of applying for these programs at the university?
Well, this is always difficult to find the element which is then starting everything. But I think that one of these is the fact that I'm not from Paris in France. So I'm from Grenoble, which is a very nice city with the mountains and so on, with a great university. I mean, the people in Paris, they consider that France is a bit the center of the world. From different other cities, this is not the same feeling. So maybe because Grenoble is close to Italy and to Switzerland, maybe because of my readings, maybe because then I have been listening people who used to be more pro-European than others, some politicians, for instance. And I remember at this time Jacques Delors or Raymond Barre or this kind of French politicians who were very much oriented to the European integration. So it attracted me in a certain sense to see a bit, to be more concerned by the European as a construction. And then after, because I had this opportunity to go to study in Italy at the European University Institute, which is the fabulous place where you can do your PhD after master's. And there I stay for 7 years, I mean, doing my study and then being a researcher. It was fabulous because it was open to the best mind of Europe, of the continent. So I've been very lucky to stay there and to continue to be interested in making the continent something which is a different place in the world.
Taking off from that, I know that you've been recently writing in light of the pandemic about sort of refounding the EU. Could you tell me more about that?
Listen, the European Union is a fabulous process which start not just after the Second World War, but even before in the writings, in the mind of different people.
According to him, the goal should be for the union to function more efficiently. He says that the decision-making process can be significantly improved, especially when it comes to important economic decisions or decisions in times of a crisis. The idea of refounding would be for the EU to work better and deliver better results to the public.
You can see also that in public opinion polls, that in a certain number of countries, the people are not satisfied by what's going on at the European level. So the point of refounding the European Union is just trying to be seated on the, around the table and to find the best way to move forward, to find a new decision-making process, to make sure that the whole institutions are more democratic, more legitimate, and making sure that this continent will continue to offer the best future for the kids. I mean, this is something that we can see at every European Council, that things could be improved, for sure. The question is then to make sure that everybody will agree with the improvements that we can put on the table. And this is very complicated because of the national sovereignty. So the point of the European Union is to make sure that we continue this integration, making sure that we offer more opportunities to the people working on this continent, and to face in common and in the best way the challenges that are always new. And we can see that with the pandemic.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that this is a very valid point, taking into consideration what you said, that massively the public opinion across member states is that things could be working better and things could be made simpler. It's not an overly complicated thing to do, but I think that someone would have to kind of champion the conversation. But then again, you'll be at the catch-22 that to implement some of these changes, you would need unanimity. So it would be curious to see how something like that could play on.
There are some technical elements. I mean, the parliament, for instance, could have the possibility to be an agenda setter. I mean, this is one of the few parliaments in the world which has not the capacity to decide its own agenda. That's one. Maybe we have to simplify the Commission and the President of the European Council. It could be just one. Instead of having the President of the European Council and the President of the Commission, we could have just one President with the Commission. We could try to reduce the number of the Commissioner because 28, one by nation, this is maybe not the optimum solutions, because then every commissioner will feel more like a national guy put within the commission instead of having a more European conception. I mean, there are a certain number of things. And of course, the unanimity is a problem. When you are obliged to have all the member states accepting something, sometimes this is the best way to do not move, because you have always one country which will block the others. So there are a certain number of issues, areas where there is no unanimity as a condition for the decision-making process. And we see that there are four or five policies, I mean sectors, where already the Commission had the capacity to decide without coming in a systematic way, coming back to the member states in order to know if this is okay. We can say about agriculture, we can say about competition, we can say about monetary policy. All these sectors have a decision-making process which is working better because there is no unanimity. Remember that Schengen has been created by five member states. I mean, we knew at this time that it was not possible to move forward within the European Union, but five member states decided to do that outside by intergovernmental treaty. It worked, and then after step by step, all the other member states wanted to be a part of Schengen. And then at the end, Schengen is part of the European Union. So if there is the will, we will find solution. Even if there is unanimity into the current treaty, we can do that outside as a starter. And then the other one will, the other member states who may be reluctant and so on, they may accept to enter. So, I mean, technically speaking, there are solutions. The point is just to make sure that there is a will, a political will, to continue to accept to share sovereignties at a supranational level and to consider that one nation is not enough at now in our time to decide for everything. I mean, there is no sense, no body will be enough clever to explain that the environment and the climate change could be done at one national level. No one will say that terrorism, migration will be resolved at one national level. So we have to find a way to make sure that for a certain number of obvious questions, this is a supranational level which is taking a decision. Of course, with the flexibility, with the possibility to exception and whatever, but we have to continue this movement to understand that our continent, the European continent, should be organized in a better way to make the life of the people better, and it needs to have some reform of the institutions and the European Union.
So, you know, a lot of the reactions during the pandemic, although in some cases right, were perceived as untimely. And now we're also faced with the issues with the vaccinations and how fast that is going, how deliveries are going, what was negotiated, how was negotiated. So I'm hoping that at least some of what you say we see soon. And just because we're running a bit low on time, you twice referred to your time in Italy during your PhD. And I know for a fact that you've translated an entire book from Italian to French. Can you tell me how that happened?
Oh, this is very simple. This is the a friend of mine who used to be advisor of Romano Prodi when he was president of the European Commission. And I was advisor of Jacques Delors, previous president of the European Commission. And when we the two presidents were meeting, I mean, we did organize the meeting. I mean, it was in Bologna this time. So I met this advisor. Then he became a member of the parliament. Now he's a member of the European Parliament. He used to be Secretary of State for European Affairs in Italy, so he is a good friend. And we discuss about what we could do or should do concerning the Erasmus generation at a certain point. And we decide that he will write a book and I will help him in the writing and in the translation in French. So it was just by friendship in a certain sense.
That's nice. It is very interesting, and I'll tell you why. About 2 years ago, I did this Leadership Academy at the European Commission, so it's all 27 at that point already of us. So they ask us a question, and it's, how many of you have done an Erasmus exchange? And I think it might have been just one person that hadn't done it. So my question from that is, what do you think of the Erasmus generation?
This is a lucky generation in a certain sense, because this Erasmus program is one of the best tools that the European Union has been able to provide for the young people. Of course, this is not enough. Of course, this is for a certain category of people. For instance, I was not capable to go to Erasmus because I did not have enough money to complement the grant that you got in order to go in a different country. I mean, you have to need also some additional money to do an Erasmus. But I think that this is one of the best tools for the young to understand, to go in, to live in another country, to see how the people are thinking, living. And of course, after this stage, this period in another country, you will have a different perception of your own country. So that means that you start to be a bit more independent in the way of seeing your own country, national interest, the way of living. So this is a very good way of making the European Union as a process of understanding the differences and learning process of the alterity. So that's it.
I knew that François used to teach at two universities, because when I invited him for this interview, he said that after teaching, he was no longer scared of any questions. I wanted to know what he thought of teaching.
Oh, on 10 years? no, but the point of teaching, and again, when I will have finished this mission here in North Macedonia, I will teach again, because this is one of my greatest pleasure to be in confrontation with students, in order to want to organize in my mind what I have done, or a topic, or something. So when you're teaching, you're obliged to organize and to think about in a more systematic way, and to confront the reality with the academy. So that means the literature, what the others are saying, or what they are proposing as best way of moving forward. So this confrontation between the reality and the literature is important. And you have to explain that to minds, to people, to students who are very critical, who are not affected by their own professional life, so that they have still this capacity to be provocative, to be innovative, and you're obliged to answer them. So this is always a kind of in-comfort zone to go to teach, because you don't know what the guy in front of you, how he will react of what you're trying to transmit to him. And this is this exchange, which is fabulous, because you try to not to tell how they should think, but how they should question the world, how they should question the more important is not the things that you will tell them, I mean, as a substance, because they can find in books there are always somebody else who could have more or less the same kind of explanation. But the point is just to make sure that they question, they continue to have this curiosity about the world, about the practice, what's going on, and to make sure that they understand what is behind the scene. That's the most important, to make sure that they continue to be curious, because this is the best way to improve decision-making process, or even understanding better the society in which we are living.
Wow, I think anyone having you as their professor at university would be lucky with the way you think, that it's not about telling people how they should think, but more about how to question. And yeah, I think you're also very brave to want to teach. So yeah, I wish you luck, and I hope that it's a good experience on both ends. And you know, we're slowly going towards the end of our conversation. And usually this is the point where you and I talk about what I should do in the future. And you're a very big proponent of me going back to Bulgaria and fighting for political change there. So I'm curious to, what does someone like you, coming from Western Europe and having all of these experiences there, see in a region such as the Balkans?
This is Europe, and I continue to think, and that's why one of the reasons why I came here. I don't think that the European Union will be a global player will be capable to continue to play a role at the international scale if we are not capable to make sure that these regions, the Balkans, Western Balkans, are not completely integrated in the European Union in one sense, and making sure that the population is not having better life conditions. We cannot pretend to tell what Africa should do in this country or in this country if here we still have a bilateral dispute between North Macedonia and Bulgaria, between Kosovo and Serbia, or other. So this is also a concrete example of how to make the European Union a better tool for the modernity. So this, of course, this is not easy because there is a long history of everything. But I consider that this is the our task to make sure that the 20 million of people living in the Western Balkans will be part of more or less at the same rhythm, at the same speed, at the same pace than the current 27 member states. And this is our business. I mean, we should be aware of making sure that this is still a priority for the European Union.
Yeah, I agree. I think, and this is partially why I enrolled in public policy as opposed to doing international relations or anything international, as you say, like quality of life, how to make that better. From my perspective, make regions like that more attractive for the people that are already there, and perhaps in time for the people that left to come back. So this is something I've been thinking a lot on. So I'm very grateful for this interview. Is there something I didn't ask you that you want to tell me?
No, I think that what you're doing is a nice exercise, because of course we are obliged to think a little bit about current activity, past, and I think that we touch a certain number of important issues in terms of European integration evolution, the importance of the Western Balkans, the role of politics, and how an advisor should be involved or not in politics. No, I think that this is a nice exercise, and I would like to thank you, Tania, for this.
Don't forget to check out our other episodes on Spotify, Google, or Apple Podcasts at The Political Show and Tell. You can also find transcripts of the episode on our Facebook page.